be a very valuable part. There's lots more things with data I could go into, but what I really want to spend some time in this talk is the results we had for the study. This is a big component of the paper. So we took the dead tool, and we've been taking snapshots of the top 50 free applications in every category of the Android market for some time. So that gives us a set of 1,100 applications for each of those snapshots. And we threw dead at one of these. And when we decompiled it, we got over 21 million lines of source code. That's a lot of source code for any of you who've tried to do some program analysis on that. So we want to do some static analysis on this. We want to look for dangerous behavior. We want to look for vulnerabilities. We want to try to make some sense of what's going on here. Now, a little caveat with this, the findings that I'm going to present to you, this is the results of static analysis. Static analysis will tell you what can happen, not what necessarily does happen in different runtime environments. It doesn't look at user inputs. It doesn't look at configuration files that might be outside the purview of our analysis. It also only looks what's there. So if code is going to dynamically download other code and try to execute that, we're not directly looking at that. There's extensions you could conceivably do to do that, but we're not going to look at that in this particular study. So okay, we have a lot of code, and we want to do lots of different types of analysis at it. Where do you start? What sorts of tools do you want to use to bootstrap this sort of study? And so we thought about using some custom program analysis tools, using frameworks like Walla, and sort of writing our own custom algorithms. But we really wanted to focus on the what, not the how. And so we looked what was available from that perspective. And so we came across the Fortify SCA tool, which those of you who have used it, you might know that it has some industry standard Java vulnerability analysis in it. But you can also do custom rules. And this is where we're really able to leverage this framework. There's four different types of custom rules you can express within Fortify. The first type are control flow rules. This is where you specify finite state machines. It's great when you're looking to see if different options and objects were set, and then if that object was set in an API you care about. Great for a lot of the vulnerabilities. A lot of the rules we have for the vulnerabilities were encoded in control flow analysis rules. Second, we have data flow analysis. This is your static taint tracking. Great for finding information leaks, great for finding injection attacks. The third one is structural analysis. Think of this as grep on steroids. If you grep for a token, you're going to find every instance of that actual string. This structural analysis gives its other clues. It's a variable versus a method. What is the class of that method? What are the superclasses of that method? So a lot of additional information, which is really going to help you hone in on the important parts. And the last one is semantic analysis. And this one isn't documented so well in the Fortify white papers. But we kind of came across it by chance by looking at the schemas for the language specification. And the cool thing about semantic analysis is you can look at potential values for variables in certain instances. And we turn this is actually turned out to be pretty useful for looking for hard-coded SMS or voice numbers. Now, I do want to do a quick thank you to Fortify. If there's anyone here from Fortify, they gave us a complimentary copy of Fortify to do the analysis. And they also helped us out a bunch with some quirks with the custom rules. Here's a quick overview of the different types of analysis we did. I'm not going to go through them right now. They sort of will come out as I'm reporting the findings. Some interesting things to note. So we also threw at the industry standard Java vulnerability checking, and we found that a lot of these rules are written for server applications, and Android are client applications, and so a lot of the assumptions that they made to build these rules, they just don't apply. There's a lot of things that they were caught that really weren't going to be issues. For the individual rules, if you're interested in sort of how we constructed those, the finite state machines, the taint sources, the taint sinks, the structural rules, we didn't actually have room in the conference papers to put them, but if you really want to know what's going on with those, we have them in a technical report which you can grab off my website. Now into the study results. The first area is with phone identifiers. And we've seen phone identifiers as being a problem in previous work. This is one of the things that we found with Taintroid. But again, we want to get at the why. Why are these applications using phone identifiers? And so in addition to looking for these checks, we did manual analysis for almost all of the results from our program analysis. So we were looking at a lot of source code for this, but at least we're pointed in the right direction. I'm going to show you some examples in a bit of why being pointed in the right direction is a great way to sort of push away the mess. So categorizing this, different ways we're seeing it used, device fingerprints, getting not just the phone identifiers, but everything they can about the device from the OS version to the size of the screen, tracking actions. For example, every time you do a search, it's going to include the IMEI in it. And also, we've seen them being used along with account registrations and logging into to accounts. I'm going to talk a little bit about the implications of that as well. So here's our first example. You can't read this, I know that, but if you would just look at this, you see lots of different cases where lots of different types of information is. So this is just a big glob that you sort of we can identify with this program analysis. Next, probably easier to read example is this one in the white and yellow pages application. And there's this class phone stats. And there's this two URL formatted string. What this does is it gives you a string to append to your actual queries, to your URL HTTP GET queries. And in there, we can programmatically very easily add our IMEI or model of our phone and some different properties that we're interested in. Here we see some examples of tracking. The top one is a keyring application. So get like the loyalty card sort of keyring application. And here, this is inside of the main activity. For those of you not familiar with Android terminology and activities user interface, the main activity is the one that starts when you start that application. And in the onCreate method, well, this is the first thing that's called in there. Think of this code like a main. We have a variable IMEI, and we're going to grab that. We're going to get the IMEI from the device ID API, and then we're going to put this into this retailer lookup command, which is later used for populating a database of retailers. And so when we do that action, we're sending off the IMEI to the content provider. The one below is this com.qnar application. This is a flight search application. This is in a class that's used for doing various sort of network tasks. It's a separate thread. And in the run method, we're grabbing the IMEI, and we're including this in a search URL. Here is the State Farm Pocket app application part of the code. And this part of the code links to the callback for the button that you press when you log in. You don't see all the code here because it's actually spread across a number of different classes. Again, the advantage of having some program analysis tools to point you in the right direction. But this code takes the IMEI and includes it in that login process. Now, I've actually stepped back a second here and say, well, what sort of advantages or disadvantages are there of including the IMEI in the login? Well, from an advantage point of view, maybe when I'm logging into my account, I can see that this is the device. So this is Will's device. This is Will's login. And if I would happen to log in another device and another device, I'm seeing different IMEIs. I might want to raise a flag and send Will an email and let him know that his account might have been compromised. On the negative side, if you think about what's actually happening, is we're taking personally identifiable information, things like my email address, my account identifiers that map back to me, and we're associating them with IMEIs, right? These are these strings, these digits that we've been talking about using tracking before. People saying, well, how do I associate that back to me? But we're making these little databases, and we're putting them out in lots of different places as opposed to just having them in the cellular provider. So there's potential good and bad aspects of this. On the location front, again, similar things as we found in Taintdroid. Lots of legitimate uses of this. Location-aware applications are great. They're going to be using that. We're going to find it with these analysis tools. We also found it with going off to advertisement servers. Again, similar findings we saw with Taintdroid. Unfortunately, there was a code recovery failure in the AdMob code, right where it was getting the location. Otherwise, we would have found enormous amount of more of these data flows with location. Different sides of sort of dangerous behavior. Moving on to some types of phone misuse. We looked at a number of different things. One of the things they look for were hard-coded SMS numbers. So basically, if you send a message to a hard-coded number, it might be a premium rate number. Therefore, you might be a Trojan of some sort. We didn't find any applications in our sample, but this was a limitation of our sample. We were looking at popular applications. You would probably find a different set in a different set of applications, whether or not you find that. So this could be a great tool when you're doing malware research. Recording of audio and video in the background. We didn't find anything with this, but I think the rule turns out to be pretty valuable. And what we did with this one is we look where the application is calling the record audio and video, and then we do a call graph back to an activity. Again, activities of the user interfaces. So if there isn't a path from a user interface component to recording audio and video, that's in the background, most likely the user's not going to know about that. We only had 9 false positives for this one. We weren't really focusing false positives being a requirement. But these were due to code recovery errors. We fixed that, and it became a pretty valuable tool with this. We also looked at use of socket APIs. One of the interesting artifacts of Android is there's these great HTTP wrappers, and apps aren't using socket APIs very frequently. Very few applications were using these. And while it might not be indicative of botnet behavior, it's a place where you might want to start investigating these apps a bit more. And we look for also harvesting lists of installed applications, and didn't find anything particular with that. On to libraries. Not surprisingly, lots of free apps had libraries, ad and analytics libraries in them. What was more surprising is the number of these ad and analytics libraries these applications had. One had as many as 8 different ad and analytics libraries in it. Why do you need more than one ad and one analytics library? I can't tell you, but these are the sorts of things we're seeing. We also have some perspective of where code is happening, because we have this, when we decompile these, we have the namespace of the code, so we know what's in the library. And on the right, if you can see it, this is also in the paper, the different types of privacy-sensitive information these libraries are getting. So how did we get that? Well, in one case, we're gonna try to get it, and then we're gonna catch an exception. And so if an application doesn't have one of these permissions, Android throws a security exception. But the library knows that might happen, so it catches that. It's gonna probe for permissions in this way. Now this, if you're doing some dynamic analysis in your tools, you might say, hey, I'm just gonna look for failed attempts. That doesn't get all the cases. Here's another case, the web, this is the Casey ad SDK. It's gonna do the right thing. Let me probe this, check. Does this have the read phone state permission? If so, then I'm gonna grab the, in this case, the ICC ID. So these are different ways that these libraries are gathering this. Other types of libraries we found interesting to look at is something we call developer toolkits. These are just utilities that developers take from application to application. A lot of times there's dead code in these developer toolkits because it's never being used for anything. But a sort of a higher level takeaway of something we found from this is it's not always clear when you go browsing these applications in the Android market who developed the application. For example, the USA Today application is provided to you by USA Today, and the Fox News application is provided to you by Fox News. But they both have this common library, com/mercuryintermediate. You go to that website, and they advertise, we created the USA Today app. But in that code associated with that library and also in sort of the startup routines is this functionality to grab that IMEI and send it off. So it's not always clear, is that brand name that you know really the one who's developing these applications? It's often being contracted out. Again, we're seeing things like probing for permissions. This is one of my more favorite code examples to show. This is a custom exception handler. And when this exception gets thrown, it tries to grab your phone number, and if it does, it sends it off to the developer. And I can just imagine using an app, having it crash, and then 5 minutes later, the developer gives me a call and says, so what were you doing when my application crashed? Now, I don't think this was the intention, but it's amusing to sort of speculate what the developer really had in mind when they put this stuff in. On the vulnerability side, one of the things we focused at were intents. And intents are Android's main way of doing IPC between applications. Independently, Erica Chin and some folks at Berkeley were looking at different types of intent vulnerabilities. They had a paper at MobiSys earlier this year. We looked at some slightly different things. We had access to some source code to get some additional details of what was going on. Just a brief overview of some of these. Leaking information to IPC, this is sort of broadcasting intents out. If you don't protect it with a permission, anyone can get access to it. This is a vulnerability if you put sensitive information in that. We looked at a lot of these cases and mostly found things like task identifiers and widget identifiers being sent out. So you really want to look a bit more, get some more context if you were trying to make maybe a certification tool out of this. We did find some sensitive information like location. In one case, it was an instant messenger application was just broadcasting out your IM status for everyone to listen to. Intent injection attacks are, I think, a very important area to think about. Think about command injection attacks on Windows and Unix. And the analogy applies here. Intents are the way of doing actions on Android. So you're getting intents in, you get data from them, and if you use that data as the destination for the next action you're going to do, there's a potential injection attack here. And there was a number of applications that looked like there was a potential for it. Didn't look like it was easily exploitable to do anything malicious, but we need to start worrying about what's happening with that. And then last one down here to mention quickly is null checking on these intent inputs. Nobody's checking for null to see if these values actually exist. Now, fortunately, a lot of this is an activity, so your app's just going to crash, and you're going to say, oh, what happened there if someone tries to exploit it? But some were in services, some were in broadcast receivers, which could silently kill an application. So that's just a quick overview of the vulnerabilities. Want to mention briefly some limitations. As I mentioned before, the sample set, we focused on popular apps. Future studies, be nice to look at different types of applications. We had to start somewhere. So we thought the apps that people use is a great place to start characterizing these types of things in code. Code recovery failures, I mentioned some implications of that. DED had about a 99.4% recovery rate of classes, but when we decompiled that, the state-of-the-art Java decompilation tools brought us down to about 94 to 95%. And this is similar to what we found just decompiling Java applications in general. Android IPC data flows. This is these intents that are going between parts of an application. It's out of the perspective of most Java analysis tools. And you need to get a little extra logic in there to figure out what is the value of this action string that's going to be used to determine where this data flow actually goes next. And we're working on some more customized tools to advance in that area. The Fortify SCA language lets us express a lot of things we're looking at, but there's some things we wanted to express we couldn't. Think about trying to place a data source for taint tracking. On, if you're familiar with Android, on the content providers, it's a very generic API. You have to know for the address book, for example, the value of that authority string. And so we didn't have the expressibility within this language. Again, places we can advance with some more custom tools. And then the last thing with obfuscation, a few of these apps were obfuscated. It didn't affect control flow analysis so much as manual inspection to figure out what they were actually doing. Getting to the meaning of all this, we have lots of findings, lots of details in these findings in the paper. I didn't go through all of them today because I did not have time for that. We had a lot of great rules, which I think could be very useful, a lot of great sort of intuition about what these apps are doing. If you really want some sort of more meta takeaways, some of these APIs I think we need to do a lot more oversight on, whether it's providing some developers with some better tools to prevent vulnerabilities, maybe making some different use of these permissions, maybe applying these tools in sort of a certification sense to figure out what's going to happen when you use these APIs in different ways. And another major sort of takeaway are these ad and analytics libraries. This is what I'm calling fourth-party code, right? You have third-party developers with code from someone else, they don't know what's doing, and they're just plopping it in their applications. There's a lot of fluidity in Android's OS architecture. I don't see why we're not moving this code off into other applications. And it's actually the third talk today is giving an example of how do we do this with ads. And as I mentioned, one of the future directions for this is a lot of potential to do some automated certification, but there's a lot of technical hurdles for getting over that. So as Dave mentioned, I'm off to NC State now. Just wanted to make a little note of that at the end, and I'd love if there's any questions. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Bill Sully. I'm at Oracle. You mentioned IMEI. Is there any implication for that besides privacy, for example, if you give your phone away or sell it to somebody else?
Depends on how the IMEI, in some cases, is used by the applications. I remember one was using some of the phone identifiers to create some mock account logins. It was just one sort of obscure application. If that starts happening more by developers, then there's, again, links to accounts, and then there would be concerns with that. A lot of the concerns are privacy, though.
Developers are not intentionally being malicious, they're just making mistakes.
A lot of cases, for the ones that we saw, yeah.
If that's true, it's possibly similar to the scenario with Social Security numbers where it's just the easiest way to get a unique identifier. And instead of generating one that doesn't have connections to the lifetime of the phone, they're generating one, they could be using one that's less connected and less privacy leaking.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you think there are ways to address that with the API or the permissions to make it so there is an easier way for phones to get unique IDs so they're not, for applications to get unique IDs instead of doing it in the privacy compromising way.
Absolutely, I think that's a great approach, and I think there's a paper at CCS this year, the AppFence thing that work I think does that, and there might have been something with MockDroid at Hot Mobile earlier in the year. Did some similar things.
And we do have time for some more questions.
Hi, Adrienne Porterfelt from UC Berkeley. So were the applications actually using all eight of those libraries, or were you eliminating dead code, or does that include?
So we were for that analysis was to see what libraries were included. We didn't look for code paths. That was they have them in there.
Nathaniel Husted from Indiana University. I was wondering, when you guys were decompiling the applications, did you run into a lot of native code, and when or if should we start worrying about native code?
We have some more details on native code in the paper. We sort of, it was maybe 70 or less of the 1,100 applications had native code that we were able to encounter with. But I think that's definitely an area where malware is starting to push. For those of you looking for research topics, I think it's a fruitful area to start investigating.
Konstantin Beznosov, University of British Columbia. So if you were to do this study again, how would you change your application sample set?
How would I, the application sample? So I think looking at popular apps is good. Actually, there's so Adrienne in the next talk, they look at also some top free apps, they have some paid apps, and get some random apps. I think we need to start, this was a lot of apps, but some of these studies, I think we need to start giving even more apps because there's hundreds of thousands of these applications out there. I'd probably try to query the list of all of the applications that I can get and then randomly pick ones out of that set and then download those APKs from there. So it's getting a more representative set of sort of the bigger picture. But the just-ins, I think, is a good metric as well. And then I think looking at some paid apps is good